The Joint Committee on Tax Credits will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2108 and Senate Bill 54. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bills 2108 and Senate Bill 54 each pertain to the physician's care at Oregon at an Oregon veterans home. Physicians are allowed a tax credit of $1,000 for every 8 residents for whom they provide services, up to a maximum of $5,000. Each of the bills is the simple 6-year extension of the tax credit.
All right, and we have John Mullen.
It's the testing people.
No, we call them assessments.
We're on the record, please. Mr. Mullen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'll go ahead and just do some very general remarks, and then I could go through all of the tax credits.
I prefer you stick with the one that we have open.
Okay.
And you're signed up on this one?
And excuse me, which?
2108 and Senate Bill 54.
Okay.
Having to do with the Oregon Veterans Home.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This one, based on our position from the Human Services Coalition, is tied in with rural medical. So I'll just go ahead and just summarize where we are. As far as issues relating to health care and tax credits, the Human Services Coalition, of course, is very concerned about access. Access is not just an issue for Medicare and Medicaid or veteran services. It's actually, now that we have 95% of Oregonians that are insured, access is an issue that relates to all Oregonians, and it has to do with workforce issues. One of the things that the Human Services Coalition has come to a conclusion in looking at all of the various tax credits that relate to incentives to get people into rural areas or underserved areas of the state is that the way in which federal and state incentives and tax credits work are not coordinated in any way. And so while we support the whole idea about making sure that we have access statewide, we support the studies from the Oregon Health Policy Board, financial incentive programs in Oregon. And I'll just really very quickly talk about a few of the things that are in that report in Section 5. Financial incentive programs are not currently designed to complement one another. There is a lack of systematized data collection to measure programs' effectiveness. Differing definitions of need may make it hard to compare the benefits of programs. There is no overreaching review or governance of the array of provider and financial incentive programs, and Oregon's range of financial incentive programs is more diverse than in many states. It is important to keep in mind the total number of providers who benefit from financial incentive programs, not just the number of programs or the investments made. So just in conclusion, Mr. Chair, would just say that for this particular tax credit, we don't have any particular concern, but they are really sort of marry up to the discussions that I just mentioned about incentives and tax credits in general relating to helping providers get to certain underserved areas. And with that, I'd be happy
to take
any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Mullen? I will note while we're looking that we've received reports both from the House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness and also from the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness on this tax credit. I think the two bills are identical, aren't they? Or very close.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. And I'm particularly interested in this lack of coordination issue. Do we have data on what the federal incentives are and the other state incentives that are related to this? I know this is something that we've discussed before in some detail, and I was expecting we'd have a more coordinated response than we've gotten so far, but there was one member of the body that had indicated a plan to work on the issue, and I'm not sure that actually happened.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, there is a bill that would actually fund some of the data collection that's necessary, and I do believe that people who are here to talk about the rural medical tax credit will undoubtedly mention that.
Well, we may have started in the wrong order then. Any questions for Mr. Mullen?
I don't have a question.
Please.
I have no question, but I have a comment.
Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you. The two primary veterans tax credits that came before the Senate Veterans Committee, we sunsetted a $3.5 million one and did not forward it. I do remember, Mr. Co-Chair, it was mentioned that some of these were kind of still up, and actually they're not. We have killed that one, and I believe the House killed that one additionally, too, in coordination. this particular credit, as you notice, is a very small credit.
Yeah.
I would echo, I guess, your approach that there is certainly the potential of merging this in with the rural medical provider tax credit. The keen issue in this that we need to look forward through that does need a little study, and I think as we go forward, several of us are going to be studying some of these pretty well in depth, whether they know it or not, especially on the Republican side. The credit that goes to the several doctors that serve the the Veterans Center that's in the Dalles is utilized to keep a doctor pretty much not on staff, but a doctor in the community serving that small community that's there. There's about 27 or 28 individuals because we don't have the professional staff and it's not built into our funding model. that makes the tax credit somewhat important in terms of providing that service, but the second thing that we haven't analyzed is, I think as all members know, that we've actually authorized a total of 3 veterans homes now, and the question is going to come back in at least one of those areas is rural Linn County in your district. And the question is where are you going to find medical providers to service this facility in rural Linn County? I don't think the issue in terms of the Roseburg one is much of an issue, and that's because we have an entire federal veterans hospital sitting a few miles away whenever that one comes to fruition along that line. And so from the Veterans Committee perspective, I think, and we forward a report, we did due diligence. All members have a copy of that report. It's not one of those reports that came from some of the committees without recommendation or just you go figure it out. there is data in there for all committee members to look at, but I think your point is well taken and the point of the testifier is well taken that there may be common ground to do, we'll just say, amendments or tampering within the rural medical provider tax credit to merge these two together to ensure that that service is still provided. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe this question is for staff. I hadn't thought about the application to the Lebanon Veterans Home. Would this tax credit apply there as well? I think they opened last month, I think in March perhaps, or April. And should actually have patients there now.
Yes, it would eventually apply to all three.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to be heard on these two today? With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2108 and Senate Bill 54. What was the next one? And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2110 and Senate Bill 52. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these are two identical bills. Also, they are the straight six-year extensions of the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Tax Credit. This is a tax credit for insurance companies. They're allowed a credit against corporate income taxes for assessments that they pay to the Oregon Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. The qualifying assessments are those used to cover the cost of claims against insurers who have gone out of business, and the credit is taken equally over 5 years. And the bills are just the committee bills. They're identical. They extend the sunset 6 years. And I would point out in the tax credit report, in case anybody read that, on this particular tax credit, it mentions that at the time we put the report together, we couldn't find any other states that offered the credit. We have since learned that there are actually about 40 or so states that do offer some form of credit. I think you're going to hear, you might hear some testimony on the nature of those credits. I think a lot of them might be against the insurance premiums tax in other states as opposed to a corporate income tax, although I think there is a mix. And I think that might have been why we weren't able to find any when we were looking before.
Okay, and do we have reports from the committee on?
I don't believe.
They just sent us the bill.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, and we have John Powell and John Mullen, please. Anyone else want to be heard? There's another chair. Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, Liberty Mutual Insurance Companies, and the Standard. These two bills, as staff pointed out, are identical. And historically, in the early 70s, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners engaged in a study of how to find a methodology of protecting the average consumer against insolvencies of their insurance company. That is, how could we protect their claims that may be pending when their insurance company becomes insolvent? As the reports indicate, this is a very infrequent happening, but it has happened historically. The NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, developed then this program of creating guarantee associations, in which 45 states adopted across the country. And in those states, the credit that's allowed, that's the subject of this bill, are most of them like the one in Oregon. And that is, an insurance company, every insurance company is mandated, if they're licensed in Oregon, to be part of the guarantee association. Once an insolvency occurs, the claims against the guarantee association are limited to the companies who sell that particular line of insurance. So if it's an annuity, that's being a company that sold annuities, then the other companies in Oregon that sell annuities then are assessed based on their market share enough to pay those claims. In return for that, they are offered a credit of 20% of what they're assessed each of the next 5 years. That was done to minimize the impact on governments that depend on the revenue. An additional limitation is, within the guarantee association, the amount that's offered to protect the consumer is limited. In the case of life insurance, it's $300,000. In the case of annuities, it's $250,000. That, in turn, limits the amount of money that might be used as a credit. And I get, as one member, when I was discussing this, called it is kind of a middle class protection, because if you have $10 million worth of life insurance and your company goes insolvent, that the full $10 million is not covered by the guarantee association. It would be the $300,000. So it's aimed at protecting the modest consumer. There are states that have the same amount of credit, but it's taken over a 10-year period. So the insurer would get 10% over 10 years. The loss to the insurer, obviously, is the loss of the use of the money during that period of time. The bill came out of the House Health Committee, I think, unanimously, and it came out of the Business Transportation Committee of the Senate. Senate Bill 52 did, on a 3-2 vote with a due pass recommendation. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And I'll note we have received the report from the Senate. Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Again, John Mullen here on behalf of the Human Services Coalition Tax and Revenue Committee. I just want to point out that the Human Services Coalition is part of the Revenue Coalition, and you've all received the report, I believe, from the Revenue Coalition, our due diligence suggestions about questions to raise about tax credits. To be perfectly candid about this, we looked at the information, and we looked at information we were able to get from the Department of Revenue in a tax expenditure report, and we did not fully understand this, the purpose of the tax credit. Mr. Powell certainly is an expert in this area. I defer to his knowledge. We simply went ahead because we could not fathom or understand all of the elements of it, just suggested that it be allowed to sunset. In other words, it didn't measure up to where we understood the value of this particular tax credit. And so with that, we would just say that again, we are not experts in this area. We tried to figure it out to the best of our ability. And I've heard Mr. Powell talk about this on a couple of occasions, and I'm not sure I could pass a pop quiz on what it does. But in any event, just for the record, that's where Human Services Coalition is.
Thank you.
And yes, Mr. Chairman, please. If I might, I did forget to point out in the LRO report, it indicates that historically, over the last several years, this has averaged, the total average has been $1,000 a year. And I think the report indicates that an expectation from the revenue side of $50,000 a year.
Just
so again, it's rarely used, and when it is, it's not an expensive credit.
Right. I'm reviewing the material that appears to have come from LRO. Yes, it suggests $10,000 a year, so it's even better than you.
It's small.
Yeah, it's small.
Mm-hmm. $10,000 for this biennium and $100,000 for future biennium. So you're right, $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. I'll just bellow. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So your description of it, to me, it's like insurance for insurance companies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith Warner, it's insurance for the consumer who purchased insurance and is not going to receive a claim payment because of the insolvency. So the other insurers who were competing against this insurance company then offer to pick up those claims for that period of time, and then in essence the general fund ends up, all taxpayers end up picking up that expense over time. The insurance company's out the use of their money during that period, and they also pay administrative expenses that are not deductible for the association activities.
But I would just like to follow up and say that indeed then the insurance companies do get reimbursed for that cost that they cover. So really, as you pointed out at the end, it is the taxpayers who are.
Mr. Covered. Chairman, Representative Smith Warner, that's correct.
Okay. Other questions?
Can I ask one more quick question?
Oh, yes,
sorry.
Please, and then
just,
Representative
just
Davis.
To confirm, so the members of the, oh, darn it, that just closed. Hang on a second. So the members of the Guarantee Association, do you pay dues or annual contributions to be a member of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith Warner, this organization is established in the states that have a guarantee association. In Oregon, the director of the DCBS has to approve the selection of the board members based on a broad representation of all insurance companies that might be affected. That board then goes about assessing two classes of assessments. The A assessment is for their administrative costs of running the association. They usually have a part-time staff person. And I believe in the case of Oregon, Idaho, they share an attorney to basically run the association. They pay through those types of assessments and any bank account as fees and those sorts of things. That assessment is not deductible, and they do not get reimbursed for that in any way. The second assessment, the Class B assessment, is to pay claims. So if there is an insolvency, they find out what the total cost of the claims pending would be. Then they assess the Class B assessment against all insurers who write that line based on their market share. And once that money is accumulated, they pay those claims. If that's not enough, they assess again until all those claims are paid. And that is the Class B assessment, is the assessment that then they get a tax credit for.
Okay.
Representative Davis, and then Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both for your testimony. When was the last time an insurer in Oregon went insolvent such that as the Guarantee Association had to make the guarantee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, I'm not, I cannot remember an Oregon insurer, but remember, if there is an insurer from another state that is writing business in Oregon, those policies that are in Oregon are subject to this protection. So if a company from Idaho becomes insolvent, but they had written insurance in Oregon, those policies in Oregon would be subject to the Oregon Guarantee Association. So that's why the NAIC, that's why this model the NAIC put together is aimed at being a national safety net to protect consumers everywhere. And as the report indicates, there have not been many in the life and health field. Frankly, what happens in most cases when an insurer becomes distressed is another insurer takes them over, and there is no insolvency, and that's what usually happens. And there was one other point I was going to make, and I forgot it.
Right. We have, I simply note for the committee, we have two other concepts to deal with today that are significantly larger than the two we've dealt with so far. Representative Whitsitt, please.
What happens if the companies choose to leave Oregon? They just choose to leave. Is that the same thing as, does it fall under the insolvency thing? Or I know that has happened on long-term health care insurance, for example.
Co-Chair Barnhart and Representative Whitsitt, in the case of long-term care that you're pointing out, there would not, and an insurance withdrawing from a market, the policyholders in those cases still have a right, because that's a contract. They still have a right to that contract, pending if a company totally goes out of business, they would have a chance prior to filing a claim to get other coverage. So the Guarantee Association would not pick up a situation where somebody's withdrawing from the market. For example, in long-term care, MetLife quit writing new policies, but they didn't cancel the people who have their policies. And I noted in a previous hearing you talked about the long-term care issue, and it is very much in distress, but not to the point of causing insolvency.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2110 and Senate Bill 52 and open a public hearing on, House Bill 2569 and Senate Bill 44.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, taxpayers who contribute to a public university venture development fund are allowed a tax credit equal to 60% of the tax credit. It's taken equally over 3 years, up to $50,000 per year with no carry forward. In the summary for these two bills, which are identical, there are about a half a dozen proposed policy changes. And even in the drafted version, those didn't come out exactly the way that the proponents had intended. So I believe there will be some suggested changes even to the A version that you have. And I think you're going to hear about those from the proponents.
Great. So we should listen to Joe Janda, Michael Marusik, and Brian Wall. And I have John Mullen signed up for the next panel. Is anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill? Okay. Gentlemen, state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Sure. thanks, co-chairs members of the committee. I'm Brian Wall. I'm Associate Vice President for Research, Commercialization, Industry Partnering at Oregon State University. Appreciate your time today. We've met individually with several of you and certainly appreciate your time on this. It's also gone through the Higher Education Committee and the Senate Education Committee, so I just wanted to acknowledge and thank Senator Haas and Representative Reed for your time on that as well. University Venture Development Fund is a fund primarily that supports entrepreneurial education as well as commercialization of university research that drives economic impact in the state of Oregon. Combined, the universities in Oregon bring in approximately $750 million a year in federal funding from federal agencies. The majority of those fund basic research. Not a lot of applied research funding available through federal sources. Certainly furthers the science and technology and provides valuable training to our students. And discoveries arise during this research phase, but they're very embryonic. They're incredibly early. So both in more targeted research funding and protecting the innovations is really where we offer the opportunity for significant economic development impact for the state. Universities in Oregon that have high research input have offices that are staffed with professional staff. We evaluate inventions. We look for ways to protect and look for ways to fund further research to actually target that research to a particular need. You see there's a slide where this University Venture Development Fund kind of plays a key role. So basically, starting on the left, you know, is where we really have these kind of early stage ideas. We move down into proof of concept. And so the venture fund is a fund that there's no federal sources. There's really no state sources that play in this space. Investors don't invest in this space. It's super, super early. It's really where basic research kind of comes out. We have a sense that there's something really interesting here, and we've got to find a way to actually target it towards a problem, and that's where we push it. We collaborate in depth with our signature research centers who have gap fundings. They play a role a little bit later in the stage once we've kind of shown that this research actually has some value. We've kind of proved the concept. And then we move into the commercialization stage where we work with entrepreneurs and investors who are then ready to invest the funds necessary to take an idea and create a company around it and take it to market. This timeline is incredibly long for these startups and these innovations because they're heavily science and technology based. These aren't primarily, say, software based, which may have a much shorter time frame, but the impact potential is huge. And so as we move through the slide, this fund also has a return associated with it. And so if and when a startup is successful and starts generating revenues, royalty revenues will come back to the university, which will then continue to put forth and back into this venture fund to create more sustainable tax credits. Just going through these slides very briefly, there's been over 25 startups that have tapped into these funds that have emerged from the universities just from the inception of this fund. Again, some of these have received further funds from the signature research centers and certainly from investors. These are startup companies that are, again, heavily science and technology based, which generally speaking means they're high growth potential. They create very high wage jobs in the state and have significant growth potential. They're also really attempting to solve some real challenges that are not just based in the state but in the world. And, you know, just a couple of very brief examples. Design Medics is developing drugs to combat malaria. You know, OSU's got a fair amount of these that have spun out, and Imprias One is creating new ways to create efficiencies in electronics that would decrease the need for electricity in a substantial, meaningful way. Sweet Sense is another technology that's developing sensors to improve life-saving technologies deployed in third world countries. And so these are all examples of startups who have kind of received venture funds. They've now received investment. They're growing at a rapid rate and creating jobs in our state. We've been able to focus more and more on startups having access to this venture fund than we have ever before. We used to, as offices, look for existing companies to license our technology for, because that generally returns a greater dollar amount and costs less for us as universities to try to find homes like that. We're willing and able to take risks, like spending more on different resources to create accelerators and things like that to add to the leverage that we're obtaining with this University Venture Development Fund. I mentioned entrepreneurial education. We have interns, and we also match up these real-world ideas in our classrooms. We have hundreds of students that are working with real-world startups and real-world ideas that are getting valuable experiential education. And, you know, the states that lead the way when you look at benchmarking kind of around the U.S., they're really leveraging these federal-funded research programs. And this is our key program at our universities to really tap into that $750 million and try to make a run at creating startups that benefit the economic development of the state. This is also why a region like Corvallis just gained national attention this year, where we were listed in the top five, above Seattle, actually, in startup activity per capita. So this is a critical fund for universities to do that. I'd like to turn it over to an entrepreneur here, Mike, who's tapped into these resources. He'll share the value of the UVDF and that's brought to his company in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Haas and Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Mike Marusic. I'm the founder and chief scientific officer for MabDX, which is a biotech spin-out from the University of Oregon. MabDX makes diagnostic tests for both human and animal diseases, and I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to speak in favor of the UVDF and give you a little bit of feedback regarding how some of these funds have been used and what the benefits have been. So my background, just a bit, is in basic research, as Brian was saying, in cell and molecular biology. I was a researcher at the University of Oregon for over 30 years. And during that time, I founded the university's monoclonal antibody facility, where I had the opportunity to work with a lot of really talented researchers. And during that time, we made a lot of inventions and developed materials that the University of Oregon's tech transfer office licensed out for sale and brought back revenues. And many of those revenues are still ongoing to this day. It's been, I think, in excess of about $10 million at this point. In 2003, my partner and I started my first spin-out company, Mitosciences. And Mitosciences was based on inventions that were licensed by the University of Oregon. And so we had to license those because the university had those. And we took them and we basically multiply their value by turning them into kits and easy to use for basic researchers, and that was the basis for that company. It was a slow growth. It took about 8-9 years, and UVDF funding early on was very important to us to help. We didn't get any other outside high-risk investments. We had the UVDF funding, and then we got four, actually, phase one, phase two, STTR grants from the federal government that also helped the process. In 2011, Mitosciences was sold to a larger company, a British company, Abchem, which was a very good exit both for my partner and me and for the university, which did have an equity stake in the company. Abchem expressly wanted us, part of the contract was that we get everyone in the company, except for me and my partner, to sign up for the new entity and stay on board, because they really wanted to keep the unit intact and have it as a separate division within their company. And so Mitosciences, in the past 4 years, has stayed in Eugene. It's still in the Riverfront Research Park. They've actually added people. They've added two PhD-level people, several technicians. They now employ about 35 people. And they've increased the lab space. So they've made a really strong commitment. I think they're going to be staying there you know, for the foreseeable future. You never quite know how things are going to go, but they're doing very well, and they're very happy with how things have gone. So MitoScience is a continuing success story for the University of Oregon. It's still actually generating licensing revenues that are paid back directly to the university. And as I said, it's having an impact, you know, locally by employing University of Oregon and OSU researchers. The MitoScience has made basic research tools that were used by people, mostly university researchers, but pharmaceutical researchers studying cell metabolism, cell function, structure, and function. My new company, MabDX, which is much smaller, it's myself and two part-time people right now, and we're actually renting lab space, one of the Onami entrepreneur labs in the new Integrative Sciences building on campus. So we're small, but our capabilities are really leveraged well by collaborations with outside researchers, and that includes two different groups at Oregon State University, two groups at the University of Oregon, a group at Harvard, and another small company up in Seattle. Each of these different groups that we're collaborating with has expertise in a particular disease. We bring our technical skills to the table, and together we have some synergy, and we're you know, making really good progress. Again, UBDF funding has been important. We got funding, a collaborator and I, Mark Lead, at the College of Pharmacology at OSU, each received UBDF funding to help with development of a cancer biomarker diagnostic test for head and neck cancer, and we're working on that right now, so we're making progress there. And we also have another very exciting project. It's not UBDF funded, but it is funded by an SBIR federal grant, and that's another collaboration with Oregon State researchers that is at the Microbiology Veterinary School, and that one is really close to home because it's a diagnostic test to save little baby oysters right here in the Northwest. So this is a test that will detect bacterial infection in oyster hatcheries. For instance, out in Tillamook, there's a very important hatchery. And in Puget Sound, there are several hatcheries. And we're working with them this summer to evaluate the utility of that test. And if it works out well, again, it should help improve productivity of Pacific Northwest aquaculture. And eventually, we'll be able to expand that to nationally and then around the world, because this particular disease infects a wide variety of shellfish, and shellfish is a very large part of aquaculture around the world. So I could kind of go on with more on some of these other projects. They're very exciting, but I just want to summarize by saying that the UVDF funding has really helped me previously and in this current incarnation, and I've seen it help other people, so I think it's really valuable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I want to thank Chairs Barnhart and Haas for hearing us today. My name is Joe Jend. I'm the Director of Innovation and Intellectual Property at Portland State University, Brian's equivalent at Portland State. In the last few minutes of our testimony here, I want to talk about, reiterate again, the UVDF's place in the innovation ecosystem in Oregon. We want to talk about how it works for donors currently giving contributions to the fund, how it's been working for us, and a couple of numbers, and then go over the changes we're asking for with both versions of the bill. As my colleague Brian said, the University of Venture Development Fund is at a very critical place in the innovation ecosystem in Oregon. There's a system in Oregon that works very well to bring university and early stage innovations to commercialization. It involves a signature research centers, several angel funds around the state, accelerators at different places in the state. And the University Venture Development Fund is really meant to fill a gap between the $750 million of federal funding that universities get and a place where angel funders or signature research centers would jump in. There's a literal gap there where the technologies and innovations are too early stage for anyone else to get into. And the University Venture Development Fund is meant and has worked for the past seven or eight years at getting innovations over that gap into a stage where other people in the ecosystem pick them up. So currently, a donor contributing to the fund gets a 60% tax credit, which they have to take over 3 years at a maximum of $50,000 per year. For individuals, this has worked okay. Once we can sit down and explain to them how it works, it's a little bit more complicated than typical tax credits. But for companies who can also get this tax credit, anecdotally for us, it's been really difficult for companies to budget over 3 years, how a tax credit or a donation in any particular year works. So we think we're missing out on an opportunity here to have philanthropic arms of some large Oregon companies contribute to the fund and to this goal. For us, we've received about $7 million that we've used to seed, as Brian put up there, about 24 startups around the state. These startups have received about $100 million in follow-on funding or investment altogether. The original program started off with about $8.5 million in tax credits. We've given out about $4.2 million of those so far. And of those, about $500,000 have been paid back. So the tax credits that have been given out, about 12% of those have already come back into the state general fund through this repayment mechanism that this program has. So the changes we're asking for based on our experience over the past 7 or 8 years, well, first, of course, we'd like to extend the sunset out 8 years. Eight instead of six, because I understand we'd like to be grouped in with the economic development tax credits instead of the current group that we're in. We'd also like to collapse the payback to contributors to 1 year instead of three and add a carry-forward mechanism. So instead of a donor giving and then having a maximum of $50,000 over 3 years, they can take their 60% in year one, but they can also, if they don't have the tax liability in that year, carry it forward. And this is similar to a lot of other tax credits, we understand. We'd also like to increase the available credits from 8.5 to 25 million. As the program ramps up, and if we're extended for 8 years, we imagine that we're going to need that cap to take advantage of the donations and to really spur this program over the next 8 years. And I'll say it before I stop too. We understand is the only tax credit program with a repayment provision built in. And last, I think we'd like some flexibility in allocation between the universities. And I don't think this is laid out in the language of the bills right now, but we'd like the universities among themselves on an annual basis to be able to reallocate these tax credits so that if one university is doing really well or one university needs the cap room, they can shuffle them among themselves. Some final thoughts. The LRO tells us that the impact on this is small on a per-year basis. Again, it's the only tax credit with a payback provision. And lastly, we're pretty flexible on the details of the program. I'm willing to work with the committee on them, but we think the renewal of the program and extending the sunset is really important for us, really important for our startups, and important for commercialization of innovation coming out of universities.
Thank you. Senator Hass.
Thank you. Love the payback provision. Mm-hmm. You might want to add that to all of these. This is the same funding model as the IDA tax credit. And when they were here last week, we asked them about the ramifications of reducing their percentage, which is 70 or 75, I think. And so I would ask you, to reflect on what would happen if we lowered the 60 to, say, 50, and, where the right level is or where the tipping point may be.
Thank you, Chairman Hass and Chairman Barnhart. It's not clear to us. If we reduce the percent from 60 to 50%, if that would impact what donors are giving to the program, I don't imagine it to be much, but without testing it, we wouldn't be able to know. We also don't know what effect that has on the revenue impact going forward.
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. This is kind of a piggyback on the Senator's question, which is, first, just confirming we haven't reached the existing caps, and what are some obstacles to having reached them? So you're coming and asking for a larger cap, but if we haven't reached the, is it 8.4, then what's the justification for a larger cap?
Thank you again, Chairman Haas and Chairman Barnhart, Representative Davis. We've seen an acceleration over the past 7 or 8 years in donations to the program. When it first started, there's a lot of information barriers. Inside universities, it's the development office that goes out and gets donation, not the tech transfer office. So there's a lot of internal education that goes on and coordination. In the first couple of years, if you were to see a graph of donations, they were pretty small. But they've accelerated in the past couple of years, and I'll let Brian talk about that, at OSU in particular. And we think we're probably going to run out in the next year or two of cap space. Now, the payback should start to, I think the way the payback provision works is it refreshes the tax credits.
Yeah.
When that starts to kick in, it'll work out. from what we've penciled. Brian?
Sure. Thanks, co-chairs and Representative Davis. Exactly what Joe said. At OSU, we believe we are going to hit our threshold this year, where we won't be able to raise any more funds the way the current structure is laid out. And it took us a significant amount of time to ramp up and provide education and, frankly, get our foundation on board and understanding the value of this to our donors. Okay. And so once we did, the ramp up was significant. We have worked extensively in the past couple of years, both with University of Oregon, OHSU, and PSU, sharing our best practices of how we've ramped ours up to hit our maximum. There's trajectories there that we think we're gonna nail. This is a bit of a balancing act because it has the provision that has the self-repayment. We're looking at, you know, an 8 to 12 year period for commercialization, some of which we've hit early, so we've repaid 500,000. There's a big pipeline, obviously, of these startup companies that, if successful, could start repaying and also add to the tax credit portfolio. It's just unknown at this point. We're still feeling fairly early in terms of how all this structure will go. When we also have combined it with the extension request of 8 years, we're feeling a need to increase that tax credit basis to see how all this plays out, basically.
Please, yeah.
Thank you very much. This may be a follow-up for staff because this is rather complex how it works. First of all, it's an overall program cap, not an annual cap, correct?
Correct.
And is the cap based on certification or based on use of the credit? I presume certification.
Certification.
Okay, so there's always a delta of some sort between what's been certified and what's actually used.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for appearing before us today. Is my assumption correct that if I were to make a donation to the fund for about $1 million, then I would have a portion of that would be my money, and then I would get a tax credit back from this device for a portion of that $1 million. Is it then possible for me to zoom around to the other side and ask the university for that $1 million and put it into my organization and my research, or is there some prohibition against that type of an arrangement?
I want to thank the Chairman Haas, Chairman Barnhart, and Representative Benz. And the administration of these funds were very vigilant about not letting that happen. I don't think in the language of the bill there's a prohibition on it, but at our universities it would be a tremendous conflict of interest in many other arenas for, say, an entrepreneur to donate to the fund, get the tax credit, and then apply to the fund and get funding for their own startup company. I don't think any of us would let that happen.
One additional comment. Thanks, co-chairs and Representative Benz. We have a process to evaluate applicants for the fund that include outside investors and entrepreneurs. If an entrepreneur were or an investor were to donate to the fund, there's zero guarantee that they would have any capability or access to this because the decision making authority is actually our vice president for research with recommendation from the investors and entrepreneurs sitting on our group. If it were the point where a donation were to come in, we would make a recommendation that, you know, that conflict of interest was seriously considered in the case and make the right call on that. It just wouldn't happen.
Follow up?
Please, yeah.
Thank you. And I was just looking at the, because I also am interested in the 20% return, and I was looking at the statute itself, and it says, the university that has established venture development fund shall monitor the use of grants, so forth and so on. Income consists of cash realized from royalties, milestone, and license fee payments, and cash from the sale of equity, the university should cause transfer 20% of that income. So is there a requirement that we impose upon whoever uses this money that they give us 20%, or is it merely that whatever we get back, we give 20% of that to the state?
Sure. Thanks, co-chairs and Representative Benz. There is a there's no requirement in that provision, but the funds that are provided for any given endeavor to take the basic research and turn it into transformational research, we keep a log in our office, and so what happens is intellectual property is created or value is created based on that transformation of the research. It's licensed to an entrepreneur, an investor who creates a startup company similar to Mike. The negotiation is in fair exchange for the value of the technology in general, which includes patents and trademarks and et cetera, et cetera. Whatever comes back from that negotiation of the license agreement, whether it's upfronts or milestones or equity, when that is realized in cash, whatever that amount be, 20% continually will come back on an annual basis.
Follow up.
Please. Yeah.
Thank you. I read it that way, so it's not in any way guaranteed that we're going to get 20% of anything back. It's whatever might be negotiated, we would get 20% of. So that's of interest. The last question I have on this is whether you, this is probably for us to figure out, but I'm guessing that each one of these things doesn't pan out. Some do, some don't. And so if we were trying to determine how much we're going to get back, we'd have to look across that broad scope of your investment decisions, investment in the state's interest, and see what our true return is. So am I catching that correctly? Because to get to the point of it, how many of the investments that we have made mm-hmm. as a state have failed? Is it just going to be a percentage?
Sure. Thanks, co-chairs and Representative Benz. We're always attempting to analyze this. If you look at kind of a venture fund model, you know, a VC, for example, would see 1,000 business plans, fund 10. You know, one would be highly successful. There'd be a handful that would kind of live but maybe not return significant amounts, and then probably two or three that would die. We're in a little better spot than that purely because we're starting with a portfolio of $750 million that's gone into these research endeavors. Now, with that said, the way that the return works is if one company is highly successful out of the 25-some-odd that we showed you today, 20% of that would continue to come in and pay for the sins of the others. And so it's not just one success would only pay 20% and of what they borrowed or what they used and then cap out. It literally is, if we only had one success out of here, that success could potentially repay 20% from all.
And a follow-up, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Well, I understand that. But when we're trying to figure out any investment, you always try to put some measure on the risk being taken.
Yep.
And so rather than take refuge in future hope, perhaps you could look backwards and tell us how it's panned out so far.
Sure. Thanks, co-chairs, Representative Benz. We're still very early stage on this. When we look at an 8 to 12 year time period for commercialization, these companies are all still plugging along. There's probably been, I would say, 30 companies launched that use UVDF funding, and 5 have failed at this point in time, but we have 25 or so in the pipeline. Expected rates of failure would probably be in the 50% range, possibly more. It just depends on, of course, the funding and the investment. I'm expecting to see that 50% of what we put in, because we have a strong committee that's making these recommendations, we're basing it on these leveraged funds of the federal funding, so we already kind of know what the patent portfolio and the strength of that might be. I would expect to see a significant number higher, actually, than maybe the VC portfolio would be, just purely because we're leveraging all this. So that's what I'm targeting for, and I'm charging our counsel to have, again, the entrepreneurs and investors who are making the recommendations for us to meet an incredibly high threshold.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? I have one. I'd like you to consider, and I don't expect an answer today, but I'd like you to consider a mechanism that would allow you to lower the credit certification amount, or percentage, rather. What I mean by that is setting a cap, for example, at 60%, which is what it is now, would allow you to negotiate with a donor for a smaller percentage. That seems to me to be a method by which you can get dollars from people who are excited about the research you're doing expecting a return, but not a big one, and making a real contribution in charitable terms to your operation, just as they would if they were donating to the scholarship fund. I have no idea whether that's crazy or reasonable, but that would be a way for you to test precisely the issue that Senator Hass asked about. And it'd be useful if you could get back to us with your thoughts about that after you've had a chance to think about it a little bit.
Sure.
You understand what I'm asking? Okay. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We very much appreciate it, and good luck with your research.
Thank you.
And your business enterprises.
Thanks very much.
John Mullen, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, John Mullen with the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. The very nature of coalitions means that sometimes we have disagreements. We had a disagreement on this particular tax credit in our Tax and Revenue Committee, and so therefore we're neutral on this bill, on these bills. But 2 points I just want to make from the testimony that I heard. One that has to do with the expansion of this particular tax credit, which we're concerned about. We are supporters of IDA, for example, but we did not support the expansion because we're concerned about the net impact on the whole discussion about $14 million for $64 million in expiring tax credits. The other thing is about changing the sunset date. To reference again the proposal we put in front of you about due diligence from the Revenue Coalition, we think there should be a compelling reason for changing the sunset dates. In other words, people could come forward and say we have a reason to not be on a sunset cycle. There may be a compelling reason in this case to align it with other similar kinds of tax credits, but in any case, that's the position that we have on both expansion and sunset changes.
Thank you. Chris, did you have something?
Just on the, I don't recall if it was mentioned in the testimony, the change in the sunset date, and to point out, is an 8-year extension, which is a little unusual, and I think that's the comment you're getting right now. And as I understand, the motivation for that is actually to get it back into its original group. When these three groups were created, this particular credit was situated with other kind of research and business-related tax credits. And through an amendment, it got – there was a timing issue as this process was getting started in 2009 that moved it out of that group. So this moves it just back into that group with similar such tax credits. That's the argument for that.
And the expansion that we're talking about, is this a real expansion – or is it simply acknowledging the fact that the original cap is being reached, and if you want to utilize this device, you have to expand the cap? I don't know which it is.
I guess I would say it's a little bit of both. There was some confusion around, as we've heard with other tax credits where you have a certification amount and a tax credit amount, there could be some confusion when dollar amounts are discussed. So from my understanding, the $1 million limitation on a tax credit and the $25 million cap were really certification dollars, so that the donation cap would be $1 million and the tax credit cap would be $600,000. And the program cap would be $25 million of certifications and $15 million of tax credits. That's not the way it came out in the engrossed version.
Okay, and of course, that's not answering my question. What I think we heard is that we had an overall cap of 8-something.
8.4.
And that when that's used up, whenever that happens, the program ends. Now we're talking about a cap of $25 million. Would that be in addition to the $8 million, or would it be something else?
No, that would be a change in that total. So there would be a delta of $17
million. So we're talking about allowing them to incur over the next 8 years an additional $17 million on that number you were describing earlier, plus whatever's left of the 8.4.
Correct, because they would depend, the cap depends.
See, that's
on
a very different thing than the way we're used to thinking about these issues. Is we're talking about an amount. We're usually talking about an annual amount or a biennial amount. In this case, we're talking about a solid cap for what they can do forever.
Correct.
Is that right? Okay. Just so I understand. Other questions for staff or for Mr. Mullen? Yes, Representative Benson, please.
Am I correct, Chris, in that if I wrote the $1 million check out, I'd get a 60% tax credit back, and then I'd get a charitable contribution for the balance?
Correct. There is some confusion on that particular topic and a variety of the tax credits that we have, but my interpretation of federal and state law would be that you make the contribution of $1 million, you get a $600,000 credit, and the charitable deduction would be $400,000.
And we ought to find out what the federal rules are on that same amount. Do you get $1 million charitable contribution deduction?
That's the question. Mm-hmm.
For the federal tax return.
That's
can we find out the answer to that one? I asked that question, precisely that question, in connection with a couple of these others that we've been discussing, and I think we ought to find out what the answer is. This one isn't as rich as the other one, so you probably end up still paying something after you've made that contribution out of your own pocket, but not very much.
Depends on if you're audited.
And it depends on whether you're audited or not. Thank you.
DOR?
Yes.
Mr. Cochair, if I might, I don't have any further comments on the rural medical, which I signed up for because I gave those comments under the veterans.
Thank you.
So thank you very
much.
We'll
excuse you, yes. The department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I just want to direct you to in the engrossed version, in Section 2, Paragraph 6, requires an add-back for any contribution or any deduction made on the federal return. So even if a taxpayer does claim the full $1 million, you'd have a $600,000 addition on the Oregon return. So they would not be able to take the full amount on the Oregon return. You've already addressed that. And I also wanted to just say that the proponents of this bill have worked with the department in the prior committee about the tax credit mechanism. And in the prior law, it was for lack of a better word, clunky. It was kind of awkward. It didn't follow normal standards. And in this version, it does follow our normal carryover standards, and it's much cleaner and much the clarity is nice for the department in these either 44 or 2569. I just wanted to get that on the record that they did work with us and we like that language.
So the effect of paragraph 6, sub 6 under section 2, would be to limit Oregon's tax effect to the credit.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what we're trying to kind of figure out at what level there is or is not double dipping on federal at the federal and state
mm-hmm.
levels
right.
on this now versus what the proposal is. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith Warner, this is existing language in the current law mm-hmm. and you've dealt with the double dipping issue. So okay. even if they and there is some ambiguity about whether the entire million at the federal level would be a charitable contribution. That's what you're discussing. Even if the taxpayer takes the full $1 million, you're saying, no, you cannot use that $1 million as a basis for your Oregon charitable contributions. You have to add back the amount that you claimed as a credit. So you've dealt with the double dipping.
So this becomes an Oregon addition.
It is an Oregon addition. Thank if you. They claim it incorrectly, if they do it that way, yes.
Right. Go ahead, yes.
So wouldn't that negate, I mean, if it's added back, if the entire amount is added back, then wouldn't it negate the
Mr.
credit at the state level?
It would prevent them from getting a deduction
okay.
By operation of Schedule A to Oregon's taxes, but they would still get the tax credit that they had negotiated for, that they had bargained for. I mean, it's one of these things where you're having a subtraction at the top level, and then you add it back at the state level. Mm-hmm. Have I got that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And it's just the value of the deduction is their tax rate versus the dollar-for-dollar deduction value of the tax credit.
I think you're still asking
yes.
about the federal?
Representative Hess.
About what
yes.
happens on the federal side. Does someone still get the $1 million? Can someone still claim a $1 million deduction on their federal tax?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's the I think, the question of the day. The IRS has kind of been all over the place over the last 10 to 15 years about whether items donated to the state when there's a tax credit received in return. I mean, you think the traditional spaghetti dinner where you pay $5 for, you know, the value of the spaghetti dinner, but you've paid $50 for the ticket, you can only claim $45 under federal rules. But there's this ambiguity there with the various state tax credits, and when you get a value in return is the full $1 million in this scenario deductible on the federal return, and that's the question, the federal question. I think that under that spaghetti dinner theory, the only $400,000 would be claimed on the federal return, but that's left up to the IRS to decide.
I think Senator Riley had it right. It depends on if you get audited or
yep.
not.
Well, there is that.
And the interesting thing about that is I have very mixed feelings about it from the standpoint of people making a contribution. Their net cost, net tax cost, maybe $50,000. Their net out of pocket, maybe $50,000 for that $1 million contribution, based on the Oregon tax credit, plus the 35% reduction, $350,000 reduction in their federal taxes on schedule as a result of Schedule A, that's a pretty nice deal, especially if I can get them to name something after me at the university for making the contribution.
Mr. Chair, and then you will get audited if that happens.
That's probably true. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearings on, let's get it right here, on House Bill 2569 and Senate Bill 44, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2125 and Senate Bill 37. The first panel for that is Bob Dumig, Brian Barringer, Doug Barber, and we'll hear from staff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the Rural Medical Provider Tax Credit. Certain medical providers operating in rural areas are allowed a non-refundable credit of $5,000. There are some requirements. They must provide services for an average of 20 hours per week and be willing to serve a certain level of Medicare and medical assistance patients. And current law defines a rural area as any area at least 10 miles from a major population center of 40,000 or more. And each of the two bills simply – well, on the Senate side, it grants the 6-year extension. The House version grants a 2-year extension.
Can I have a quick question, staff?
Yes. Representative Davis, right.
Thank you, Chair. And is it correct that we did a 2-year extension in 2013? I recall extensive discussions on this.
That is correct. There was a 2-year extension, and there was a work group that tried to address some of the issues and answer the policy questions about how effective the tax credit is and if it should be modified. And it was actually much broader than just the tax credit. It gets on the coordination. I think you're going to hear some testimony to that effect.
Did we ever get a report from that work group?
That work group, I believe that was the one that was referenced. I can make sure the committee gets a copy of that report.
Okay, that'd be great. Gentlemen, just for time management purposes, we're going to adjourn just before 10 o'clock. We have caucus meetings.
Okay, perfect. Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Robert Dimmig. I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health. The Rural Provider Tax Credit was created in 1989 and began in the tax year of 1990. It is a credit of up to $5,000 on personal income taxes. It's administered by the Office of Rural Health. We receive applications, determine the eligibility, and then pass that information on to the Department of Revenue to determine just how much an individual is going to be able to take. Eligible professions are physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, certified registered nurse anesthetists, podiatrists, and dentists. Eligibility requirements differ from one profession to another, but all must practice in a rural Oregon community at least half time. And the tax credit is one of the few available tools for rural communities to attract and retain providers. The Office of Rural Health, along with the Rural Health Association, polled all 2,067 recipients of the credit in 2012 to determine its value. More than half responded to the survey, and the key findings were 52.4% reported that the tax credit was a very important in their initial decision to practice in rural Oregon, and an additional 33.9% said it was important. 68.9% reported that the tax credit is a very important factor in the decision to remain in practice in rural Oregon, with an additional 25.4% saying it's important. that 65.1% felt the credit is more valuable in retention than recruitment for providers. And when asked if the tax credit were eliminated, how would it impact your decision to continue in rural Oregon practice? 37.3% said it would make them consider leaving. 32% said they would begin looking for other opportunities, and 8.4% said that they would leave their community as soon as possible. In response to the open-ended questions asking for feedback on the tax credit, more than a third responded. The overwhelming majority reiterated the value of the credit in recruiting to or retaining providers in rural Oregon, and many mentioned that it lessens an urban-rural pay differential. This survey provides valuable insight into the impact of the tax credit. However, we also understand the inherent limitations of an internal evaluation. And that's why our office supports the recommendation of the Oregon Health Policy Board's Workforce Committee that we support data collection and external evaluation of this and all of the workforce incentive programs in order to determine what, if any, changes should be made to ensure that the state's investments are wise and effective.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association, and I want to start by saying that we had several members that would love to come and testify, but they are in rural parts of the state providing health care right now. So the OMA obviously supports reauthorizing the health practitioner tax credit in either vehicle. This incentive remains a critical tool for us to retain and recruit health care practitioners from rural parts of the state. You have our written testimony, so I'll just make a couple of comments. You know, you did task a group, an interim group, but also the Oregon Health Policy Board Workforce Committee did a very extensive study over the interim on this tax credit and other rural health incentives. And unfortunately, while there are some great reports there, both the reports from the Oregon Health Policy Board Workforce Committee, as well as the Legislative Revenue Office report, talk about the need for better data collection to be able to do a full analysis on the effectiveness and the deployment, really, of these incentives. So there's a number of us in the Oregon Rural Health Association that have asked for a vehicle, Senate Bill 757, and now there's, I think, a couple of other additional vehicles that are now down in Ways and Means to allocate some funds to do some additional data collection. I think I've said this to some of you before in meetings, but we've done a really good job of trying to create incentives to recruit and retain providers to rural areas. What we don't always do when we create those programs is ask them to collect the right data. So we come in afterwards and we say we need data collection, and we're asking the people that run the programs and are not data collection experts to do that. So we think that by tasking the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and the Oregon Center for Nursing, which are external data collection groups, to do this work, that we'll get some better data to do that. One of the examples I think that makes sense too is when you look at this tax credit, it's currently governed by size of the population center and the distance to that population center. And I would say, and I think you would all agree, that 10 miles from Portland and 10 miles from Medford are vastly different areas and different areas of need. And right now, those are our only two levers to really adjust this credit. And if we're able to do a community-by-community needs assessment and really look at the needs of those communities, what we'd like to do is then shift those incentives so that we're getting the providers in the right places. I think the other thing that allows you to do is sort of create a sort of back-of-the-napkin longitudinal study, because if you change the providers in different areas that are getting the credit, then you'll be able to stick a flag in the ground and sort of look forward as to what those changes did to those providers in that in those communities and understand if the incentive is actually working or not. So I think is also referenced in the Legislative Revenue Report. When this tax credit was implemented, it was done so with two other health policy changes. So looking back there, it's really kind of hard to tell which health policy change had the most effect on growing the providers in rural areas. The last thing I'll just say, too, is last month in the Portland Business Journal, there was an article that was titled, "Oregon is one of the worst places to be a doctor," study finds. The study ranked Oregon the 49th best place to be a doctor, and this is the perception we have to deal with when recruiting to physicians to the state. So this is also why we need to continue the support of, I think, these incentives and others to recruit and retain physicians and other providers to the rural parts of the state. With that, I'll...
Chair Barnhart, Haas, and members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association in support of the two tax credits. as my colleagues have said, I mean, there was a lot of work during the interim, both by the committee that we were all a part of with some of your legislative colleagues, as well as the Health Workforce Committee. And they really both came to the same conclusion, which is also the same conclusion that the two health policy committees came to this session on these bills, which is there's no shortage of ideas about how to modify or tweak or shift these tax credits. I mean, there's a list of at least a dozen, probably, you know, potentially good ideas. What we don't have is any clear sense of how any of them would truly impact the providers in those communities. And that's why we are so supportive of trying to get some funding for this evaluation and data collection that we need, so that we're not coming back here every 2 years going through this over and over again with essentially the same data and the same general concepts that we've had before. We know from the clinics that we work with in rural communities that from their perspective, this is the best tool that they have to recruit and retain providers. Now, if it goes away, what happens? You know, Bob talked about the survey that was done, which showed, you know, pretty big numbers of people saying that they would be looking for other jobs if this tax credit goes away. And you might think, well, that's self-reporting, and those numbers are probably exaggerated, and that may well be true. So maybe it's only half that many, which means that would only be, you know, a few hundred providers in rural Oregon that we would lose. And if you look at one of the charts in Bob's testimony, it shows the differential between providers in rural Oregon and providers in urban Oregon. I mean, there is still a big gap there. And even the communities that in rural Oregon that are doing okay, you know, that might mean that they've got all three positions filled. And if they lose one, the whole thing starts to unravel. So we really encourage support for this tax credit as we move forward. There is interest on our part, as well as others, to look at this tax credit under the umbrella of these other workforce incentive programs, which include the rural malpractice subsidy, the loan repayment program, the loan forgiveness program. They all try to get at the same topic in slightly different ways. We think they're all important. But we don't know how they really interplay because we don't have that research. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll start with Representative Davis and then Senator Riley.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. It seems to me that one way to look at the data is simply by and this is very rough, but a comparison of wages or compensation from urban versus rural areas for medical providers who would qualify for this credit. Because even if we're not talking about moving states or physically moving where a provider may live, they could drive 20 miles further and work in an urban area. So what is that compensation difference in rough terms? And Brian, I'm looking to you.
Yeah, and I, co-chairs and Representative Davis, I would have to go find that. I know from anecdotally that there is a significant difference there, but I wouldn't want to quote it until I pull that data.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
And one additional question is, you mentioned where we rank, at least in perceptions, state by state. Do we know if other states offer similar incentives for rural practice?
Yes, co-chairs, Representative Davis, in revenue staff's report of the tax credit, I think there are 7 states that were either offered similar programs or considering them, and it talks about the different characteristics of those states, which are fairly similar to what we do here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Riley, please.
Thank you. Request for gathering data, I think that's a great idea. I think what we need is more information about what the problem is and what solves the problem. If you get that money to do that, how long do you think we wait to get some results?
Co-Chair Senator Riley, it's really
It really depends. Part of it is there is a extension of the sunset in 2125 for 2 years. Mm-hmm. I think if we could get that extended to 4 years, that would give us where it would help is that we have several other incentive work programs and loan forgiveness, the loan repayment. Those are all relatively new programs. Mm-hmm. So over, I think, a four-year period of time, with the information from those new programs and what we can collect from the tax credit program, we would be able to come up with some pretty good data.
And I would just add to that that we've been working already with OCN, Oregon Center for Nursing, and the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and they are very aware of the legislature's desire to get something usable sooner than later. And so we've had those conversations. Obviously, if you do a longitudinal study, that can take a great deal of time. But they've also been talking about needs assessment by community and gap analysis studies that could be done, and all could be done sort of together. And it just depends on what the legislature in the Ways and Means Committee tasks them to do and funds them to do. Mm-hmm. So I think they're looking at a range of different things. Obviously, the more complete studies and understanding effectiveness takes much more time, but there are some things they think they could do sooner.
And if I might just add, Senator Riley, that we've begun having those conversations with Ways and Means, and as Brian indicated, a lot of it depends on exactly how much they fund and what they lay out as the specific questions they want answered, and we're just in the early phases of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yes, I think you touched on it, Senator Boquist's question, but are there other federal or other programs that forgive medical school loans for physicians that stay in rural areas for up to 5 years or something like that? I recall hearing about that, and maybe you could address that.
Co-chairs, Representative, what's it? What we have right now are two loan repayment programs. One is a federal grant that the Office of Rural Health receives, and we get matching dollars from a practice site that wants to participate. And that is a two-year commitment with up to two additional years extended. There is currently a Medicaid primary care loan repayment program, which is based on Medicaid populations that they serve. So it is both an urban underserved and a rural tax credit, and that is up to 3 years. There are two programs that are loan forgiveness. One is a specific primary care loan forgiveness program where you must be trained in a primary care rural training program, and then you must complete 1 year of rural practice for every year of tuition that is forgiven. And there's a Scholars for a Healthy Oregon program, which is runs through OHSU, which is both an urban and rural, a rural and urban underserved program, which does very similar programs. The primary care program is OHSU School of Medicine and School of Nursing, Pacific University PA program, and Comp Northwest DO school. So those four programs.
And Chris is going to find the report that contains all of this information for us.
Thanks.
So you can read it later. Other questions, Representative Whitsitt? Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. Number one, just to give us some perspective, what is 4 years at OHSU Medical School cost right now?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith-Warren, I don't know off the top of my head. I believe it's into mid to upper 30s, I believe, but I would have to check a year.
Per year?
Okay. Representative Smith-Warren, I might add that the figure that is most commonly used is the average debt load now for people coming out of medical school is between $250,000 and $300,000.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to say, I did not serve on the task force in between, and I will be very interested to see what they came up with. But I've just got to believe that the Kaiser Family Foundation, I mean, there's a lot. This is a problem. Rural health care delivery is not a new issue. It's been an issue for 40 years. And I can't believe that there aren't longitudinal studies that somebody has done or other resources nationally that we could use as part of our decision-making on how to
well we continue to work on exactly yeah. that issue, and you've heard that this is under these studies are underway, and we're continuing to work on them. Senator Haas, please.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I remember this issue from 2 years ago in this committee when we extended it for two more years. And one of the things we looked at and was to be researched was widening the ring from 10 miles outside of a metro area. And a lot of people wouldn't consider 10 miles outside of metro area to be rural. And I was just wondering if there was any conclusions drawn in the interim of why that's not a good idea or what the ramifications may be.
Co-Chair Hess, the discussion was had, I think, back to Brian's point. 10 miles from, Portland is very different than 10 miles from Medford. And there would be a number of communities throughout the state, if you expanded it beyond that 10-mile ring, that would be dropped. Now, it doesn't mean that that's not the direction we should go in at some stage, but at that point, I think people felt uncomfortable with some of the communities that would be dropped out.
And I would just add that I think that's really where the discussion started, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. And that's sort of, I think, the deficiency in that one lever is that it doesn't treat all communities the way they need to. And so I think that's our desire, is to get data so that we can go in and drill into communities, because you're absolutely right. In some areas it doesn't make sense, and some areas it makes absolute sense. And so it's how do you protect those rural areas, when you only have that one lever to pull of either distance to population center or size of population center.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2125 and Senate Bill 37. Colleagues, remember that a week from today, the Senate will be receiving, Senate Committee will be receiving the revenue estimate. The House members are invited as guests, and thank you very much, Chair Hess, for that. And so for this committee, we'll meet. We don't meet for 2 weeks. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I would ask that staff in the meantime, quickly, sooner or not later, consolidate one master list into one Excel spreadsheet for all the members of the committee so that we can start looking at these, ranking these, and making comments, because we are on a time deadline.
Yep.
And people are going to have to be buying credits here shortly.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. Members of the House committee, remember we meet again at 1 o'clock. Anything else, Chair Hess? No, with that, the committee's adjourned.
What time is the 4th?
No, with that, the committee's adjourned.
I'm dead.